Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed on Nerd Talk do not reflect those of Anime Herald. Due to strong language, listener discretion is advised. Now sit back and enjoy the show. Good evening, ladies and gents, boys and girls. It's time for Nerdy Talk, the only show where gorillas, witch nurses, and contract-making mascots come together. I'm Mike Ferrer, joined by Matt Brown and LB Bryant of Otaku Review.
Hey, how you doing?
Tonight we're coming together to try something a little bit different than what you're used to. Matt, LB, and I decided that we wanted to kind of try this out to really discuss a director and his body of work. And Akiyuki Shimbo is a figure that we all kind of locked on because he has such a distinct, striking visual style and a truly unique command of how he delivers a story, his scenery, pretty much the entire overall package of a show itself. Shimbo's career spans decades as he began his work in the early 90s, and we felt that because of the breadth of his work and the fact that he is such a unique and, in today's market, highly demanded figure, it would be really worth taking a look and a deep dive on a critical level. To prepare for this, we all watched through a list of titles spanning the director's career, which include his early days, stuff like Galaxy Fräulein Yuna and Soul Taker, to his newest stuff, which include shows that you may know of today like Madoka Magica, Nisekoi, and Meikaku City Actors. I guess we can just kind of get rolling in from the beginning with the early days. We tried to get a copy of his earliest stuff, which was Metal Fighter Miku, but that was unfortunately not feasible. But we're going to be starting with one of his other early works, Galaxy Fräulein Yuna, The Abyssal Fairy, which is based on a video game series of the same name that never came to the West. All right, don't walk away, everyone. I promise you it's not bad. But where the first two episodes of the OVA were based pretty directly on the first game, Abyssal Fairy was one of Shimbo's earliest actual attempts at taking the reins on a series. And anyone that watched the series or even played the games then went to Abyssal Fairy can tell you, it's different. It's a much darker, much more almost dreamlike tone to it that you didn't see in the original, which was pretty much a straightforward gag comedy. And you could really start to see some of his Shimbo's signature techniques start to come to light in it. So before we go any further, how about you guys? What were your thoughts on it?
Oh, man.
You mentioned Red Company in the game. It's actually kind of... Well, you may not have mentioned Red Company. I don't know. It's kind of a miracle any of their games that have made it to the U.S. You know, because they... Well, at least, you know, the Sakura Taisen franchise had a couple come over, but it's almost like they were tired of people bugging them about it, and I imagine it didn't do terribly well when it came over, you know? So, it's one of those kind of titles.
Yeah, to my knowledge, it did not do very well at all, because they brought over Sakura Wars 5, which was arguably the weakest in a niche, but anyway, we're getting away from topic there.
A little bit. My first thought when I saw the title Galaxy Fräulein Yuna is unrelated to the direction, but just the term Fräulein it traditionally means an unmarried woman, and now it's actually seen as derogatory. It's considered sexist and polite to call a young woman Fräulein in Germany. So I found that interesting that they would actually choose that for a title in a Japanese thing. I suppose it's neither here nor there, but you know, that sort of thing, you know, jumps out at me because there's like this odd love of German words and phrases in Japanese culture, even when they don't really appreciate what they mean.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I guess all I can really say about Yuna is it's as you say. It kind of starts off as gag comedy, but there's definitely this undertone of what most people know about Red Company games. You know, like there's this group of, unmarried girls, or maidens as they like to call them, otome, who are for some reason in charge of saving everyone. And just, going back to the term, it made me think, like, you know, kind of all of their work is really sexist.
Oh, God, yeah. Not, without a question. I mean, this is the company that gave you Thousand Arms and Virgin Fleet. I mean, you kind of go in there expecting some degree of sexism.
Yeah. So as far as Akihiko Shimbo is concerned, to be honest, I didn't see a whole lot of visual change, or at least I didn't notice a whole lot of visual changes between the first couple episodes, which weren't direct by him, and the sisters episodes, which are, other than the opening theme song. It's weird. Like when you watch that sequence, that's where you really see techniques that he uses later, I felt. But as far as within the episode itself, it's kind of it gets darker, it gets more meaningful, I would say. He definitely had a skill for not only showcasing why Yuna was loved, but challenging her. And that's something you don't really see in the first two episodes. But it was really that opening sequence that struck me as, his signature style of everything.
Yeah, I have to wonder if that was mostly due to, like, constraints, because this is definitely licensed work, so they probably were kind of looking over his shoulder and saying, don't go too far with this. But, yeah, I mean, I can definitely appreciate the fact that you don't see a lot of the filming techniques, but you can definitely see his sense of pacing starting to come forth in it. Like you said, he has a way of really just kind of not only highlighting but challenging the characters, but he also has a way of kind of moving things along so that it doesn't always have this, like, distinctly natural feel to it. There's definitely a slight surrealist aspect that worked well in it.
I think the only other thing that really struck me about Yuna, and this is true about the Shinbo episodes and the earlier ones, is just how just some of the comments that they allowed through. I mean, I know this is an OVA, so they could pretty much say what they wanted, but it's still hilarious to hear Yuna, like, pining over her friend and actually wanting to have sex with her.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, there's one comment she says, can I play with you later or something like that?
Yep. I mean, it's doubly surprising considering if you play the games, because, I mean, the games stopped, like, just short of that. So it's really crazy to see it go that far with the dialogue. Oh, yeah, disclaimer, I'm probably the only person in the Northeastern United States that played these games.
Well, yeah. You're probably you're also the only one who's seen Moyo Ken, I'm sure.
I'm one of very few that plays Soccer Wars, and it's Japanese too, so I've kind of accepted that I'm kind of a geek. Anyway, I think we kind of said what we needed to about Yuna. It was definitely a first step. You could see something starting to come forth, especially in that opening sequence, but you really didn't see it take off until Soul Taker. To me, that was the first series where Shinbo could be, Shinbo.
I agree, and it was a really interesting visual style for me the first time I saw the show. It was unlike anything I had seen before. And although it got a little bit weird at times, it was strangely coherent all the way through, and I think that's something that you see throughout the body of Shimbo's work. So I'm definitely looking forward to talking about that more.
Absolutely. And I can definitely agree. I mean, you saw stuff like his use of color, shading. I mean, that whole overlay style that he's really tuned over the years starts to come through there, as well as the fact that he loves to make those scene, like those set pieces, the scenery, almost seem like a character in itself in the way everything's presented, you know? Before we start talking about Soul Taker any further, maybe we should kind of explain what the hell this is. Soul Taker is...
It's about a guy who takes souls.
Pretty much. Like an action horror series, I'd say, wouldn't you, Matt? Kinda.
Horror? No.
Supernatural action type of thing. It's surreal, for sure.
Yeah, well, it's for... At least for anyone who is familiar with the term, it's... I would call it a dark Sentai.
There we go. That works. Anyway. Oh, and this is a show that opens with the main character getting stabbed in the chest by his own mother. And then he comes back to life. And he's told he has, like, this twin sister named... is it Runa?
Runa.
All right. And things happen. Turns out that this is a world populated by, like, partial souls known as Flickers, who are trying to kind of come together. And our main character, Kyosuke Date, is gifted with this strange power to kind of turn into a superhero, much like a Super Sentai, that's known only as the Soul Taker.
No relation to Masamune Date.
None at all. The whole series basically sees him looking for his twin sister, all the while he's being pursued by, like, these various groups, like, these strange, almost, like, demonic doctors from a group called Hospital or Corporation, I think it's Kirihara, that want to use the Flickers for some malevolent mean. I don't remember what exactly off the top of my head. I mean, he's definitely not alone. He's got a couple of allies, like Nurse Witch Komugi, who got her own series, actually. I'm still trying to figure that one out, but anyway.
I found that weird at the time, too, that she would, that people liked her so much that she would get her own show. Not so much.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's about the gist of it. It's surprisingly surreal, like we've been kind of mentioning. And... just a wee bit on the dark side, wouldn't you agree?
I'd definitely say that this is a pretty dark series in its own way. I first watched this series, years ago. And then when I revisited it, I was surprised by, just how dark it was. And also, now that at the time when I first watched it, I wasn't really familiar with Shimbo's work. This was one of his early series, so I didn't really know who he was. But going back to it, now that I'm much more familiar with him and some of his popular techniques that he likes to utilize, it was fun to be able to point out, it's like, oh, okay, so this is kind of where he started getting his first practice. In the first episode, for instance, you can see, there are backgrounds where there are just scrolling shapes of various sizes and colors that are just there as accents, it seems, and that's something that he liked to use early on. It made me laugh when I noticed just how many head tilts there were within the first couple of episodes, which you can't call them Shaft head tilts because this wasn't a Shaft series, but there were definitely head tilts.
Akiki Shimbo, father of the Shaft. The Shaft held tilt before he hit Shaft. This was a Tatsunoko Pro, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree. I mean, you start to see these distinct visual motifs come up. Like you said, the scrolling colors or just those scenes where it goes, like, completely dark outside of a silhouette and just stark coloration or some sort of, in this case, it wasn't a silhouette. It was usually the character in black and white, but you could see it would later morph into that. Or my favorite would just show, like, these stark shots of the background, where it's, like you said, the geometric shapes or something that is seemingly unimportant, but he just allows it to exist as a character in itself. It's, I mean, the first time I saw this, it was like 2003, so I kind of thought it was cool, a little surreal, but looking back at it, it's definitely a formative work.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely wouldn't call this, you know, like one of his best works, but it's certainly, you know, looking back on it and revisiting it now, it certainly stands out as something where you could definitely see that he was starting to experiment a little bit more, and he was it's possible that he was being given a little more freedom to try new things, try new visual techniques that you weren't seeing very much from other series.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And honestly, this came up in an earlier episode of our Nerdy Talk where Matt brought it up, actually, and upon a rewatch, I have to kind of agree. This style they was testing out in Soul Taker really came into its own with Meikaku City Actress. You start to see that similar approach to it just come back with after many years of practice at it.
Yeah, at least the scenes where there's a stark contrast and maybe you know, two or three colors in the whole composition. I think you see that throughout a lot of the shows that he does.
I mean, it's a striking style. I mean, it works incredibly at conveying the gravity of these scenes that they're using.
I think if they had pronounced it correctly, the sister's name would probably be Luna. Not wanting to spoil anything for anybody who has any interest in watching the show, but well, you had enough time.
Yeah, it's been, you know, only about 14 years at this point. Only for reference, this was out when I was in high school.
Yeah, it was around a time when I was buying anything that looked cool. Because I pretty much could. There wasn't that many DVDs on the shelves, and DVD was pretty much the only way to watch a lot of this stuff. The digital fan subs machine, as we know it now, was not really spun up yet and operating at full capacity. So I wound up buying, actually, more anime than I buy now, I think. Just kind of funny.
I hear you there. I mean, definitely, I bought more back in the day than I do today.
So I think we killed this one. Do we want to...
Yeah, I think we killed this one. So we'll pop on to Cosette. Like I said, I don't remember much of this, so I'll kind of pop in when I can, but I just didn't have time to get to it.
Yeah, no problem.
So yeah, his early years, you could definitely see some flashes of his signature style coming through, but it seems like while he did kind of show it off to a great degree with Soul Taker, his next series, Le Portrait de Petite Cosette, which I wouldn't say it's his next series, but it's the next one that we actually covered for the show, was one of the defining titles of his middle career, which I'd say spans from 2002 to 2009. And it was probably the most, LB put it the best way when we were talking beforehand, it's probably the most un-Shimbo-ish Shimbo series that any of us have ever seen. Before I go any further, I'm just going to give a quick synopsis of that, because trust me, for this one, you're going to need it.
Yo, dog, I heard you like creepy pictures. So I put a picture inside your mirror so that you can like reflect on your picture.
Pretty much. Series focuses on Andy Kudahashi, a college student who also works in an antique shop. Because, you know, that's the hot job everyone wants. Anyway, one day he sees this girl appearing in a reflection of, like, this antique, I believe it was like a wine glass, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
She appears to be kind of moving and living out her life of solitude before his eyes, and he kind of becomes infatuated with this girl, like, to an unhealthy degree. And one night at midnight, he makes contact with her somehow. He learns her name is Cosette, and that she was the daughter of an aristocrat during the 18th century. Apparently, her spirit's been trapped within the glass because she was murdered by the artist Marcello Orlando. And in order to set her free, a man has to be willing to take upon himself the punishment for the sins of Marcello. So that kind of sets the stage for a lot of really unusual stuff. I mean, we're talking physical torture, mental torture, bondage. It's kind of creepy, especially as it starts to show the effects on the world outside. Like, his friends, his relatives, the girl that loves him. Like, they're all trying to free him from what they see as a self-destructive path, which it obviously is. And at the same time, he just keeps diving deeper and deeper down that rabbit hole. I mean, it is, without a doubt, one of the strangest things I've ever seen.
Ironically, I think that this is, like I mentioned earlier, and as Mike repeated, it's definitely one of the least Shimbo works of Shimbo's career, in terms of that the art style is really just carefully crafted. It's not, you know, random shapes floating in the background. It's not stark colors or really bright colors. Everything is really muted and really carefully created. The character designs in particular were just really striking to me in this release. It's definitely a much darker release along the lines. It might be darker than Soul Taker. It's comparable in that way. But it's just a really dark atmosphere. And it, you can definitely tell that it's his work by the slow build storytelling. But it's just definitely one of his more carefully crafted creations, which I thought was really interesting. And it's something that, going over his more recent series, I haven't seen him do something comparable to this since, and it makes me curious as to, you know, if we'll ever see something like this again from him.
That's a good question, because, I mean, it seems like this might have been one of those cases where he was trying to kind of expand outward, almost, to kind of try something different than what really got him that reputation in 2001.
To me, it kind of felt like the whatever drugs he was taking in Soul Taker had kind of turned on him, and this was the this was the bad drug side effect version of his work. For me, it wound up being too abstract, and I had difficulty following it. I think I got the gist of what he was trying to do with the work, but. You know, there's a few things that do stand out. You know, the obsession of the artist coming through as the main character seems to be either possessed by the artist's spirit, as it were, or just for whatever reason behaving the same way when coming in contact with this girl. And there's a little bit of intrigue about what went down between them. You know, we know that he murdered her, but there's sort of a subtext of maybe she had feelings for him. And there's a few things going for it, but I think I agree with the sense that it's a little bit less random visually than the work, the other works that we'll talk about. I would also say that the direction does kind of take similar steps, though. You know, like it's like instead of random shapes, you'll see a whole bunch of clocks or something. It's more focused, but it's sort of the same thing in the sense that it's visuals that are supplementing the conversation in some way. Actually, I may as well bring that part out. This is one of my like overall notes. When we see these weird visuals from Shimbo's direction, I get the sense that there's usually a conversation going on, right? And there's all kinds of things going on Some make sense and some don't. But it's all of those visual distractions to me serve to focus me on the conversation. And it's a little bit paradoxical in that way, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. It's in this weird sense of, even though that you're not always seeing the characters just sitting there talking and having their conversation, but having the random shapes and cuts to focus on still keeps the conversation in the foreground so that your brain isn't getting bored just watching characters having a conversation. There's always something new to focus on. So that it makes sense in that way to me.
Definitely, I agree there. Yeah, it keeps you engaged, really. Even if it's something as simple as, say, like Zetsubou Sensei, you saw a lot of the almost like a film-ish presentation of like a bit of text appear on screen and then bounce out or something to that nature, you know?
Yeah, that's another one of the Shimboisms that I have in my master list. He likes to use filters overlaid on the scene a lot. Like you'll see, you'll see static in various places, or like a film reel effect, or there's quite a lot of things that he does there. I guess it's not unusual in anime in general, but he seems to use them with more regularity than others.
To be fair, there are more opportunities to use those too. I mean, he adores his impossible space, if you notice. Like, in Cosette, you have that endless stairwell going up. In Madoka Magica, you have a few scenes like that. In Monogatari, you have it. He adores that almost impossible space. Like, the stairways that just go forever. The hallways that lead nowhere. Stuff like that. And you really can't use those in certain contexts. You can only use them in, like, very specific instances. Well, La Petite Cosette kind of got away from that whole Shinjo-ish feel, he really veered right back towards it with a Sayonara of Zetsubou Sensei. Now, this is a really hard one to explain, just due to the nature of the show and the title itself. I mean, the title, Sayonara of Zetsubou Sensei, or Goodbye, Mr. Despair, or Goodbye, Despair Teacher, would be the best way to say it, is, like, a very, very dark slice of life comedy. It's like pure black comedy, the whole thing. That revolves around Nozomu Itoshiki, which is a teacher who, at the very beginning of the show, like within 30 seconds of the show, is shown trying to hang himself on a tree. And I think it's they don't say which park it is, but it's a sakura tree. And, yeah. Anyway, before he can kind of, die, he's saved by this incredibly optimistic student known as Kafka Fuda. And in the process, almost strangles him himself.
I think it's hilarious that her name is Kafka.
It really is. Well, I mean, I'm not going to spoil anything, but if you read through the end of the manga, they explain why. But sure. Like I said, I'm not going to explain it here because it's a, well, not only is it a spoiler,
she tries to pull him down from the tree that he's hanging himself on.
Exactly. And, the first thing out of his mouth is, what are you trying to do, kill me?
Then I'd like to mention the joke with his name is that whatever you said it was. It's Nozomu Itoshiki if you spell it from top to bottom. But if you spell it left to right or right to left, whichever he does on the board, it spells Zetsubou, which means despair.
Well, to be fair, it wasn't him. It was Kafka.
He did try to warn them not to do it.
He did. Of course, this is also the girl that calls him Pink Supervisor and pays him money to do so. Anyway, yeah, this is a very black comedy. Like, everything kind of stems from that. I mean, there's not much more I can say outside of, like, that set the tone for the entire show. I mean, right after the first eye catch, I think, there's a gag where he walks in and he says, "I'm sorry I'm late class, the central line had to be stopped." And the entire class just freezes in a spot, completely silent. Because when they say the central line had to be stopped, it usually means someone jumped in front of the train and killed himself. And yeah, that's the whole show. Well, yeah. Not the whole show, but like the whole tone of the show.
Well, you mentioned Kafka Fura. She's kind of the first in a long line of what I would call the cumulative effect of humor in the show, or the show's sense of humor. Like she comes up with a nickname for him, which he doesn't appreciate, and she offers to pay him for the right to use it. And he insists that it's not about money, but she, every day after day, you know, this is the start of it. She pays him to call him Pink Supervisor.
And even better, and then, every episode is more and more money.
Right. And each successive episode, there's another student who shows their weird trait, as it were. You know, one of them is a shut-in who they scare out of her house, and now she's a shut-in at the school.
Yeah, one's a stalker.
She shows up, you know, in random places, and one of them is a stalker who falls in love with the teacher, and you know, they have to every episode they have to give her time. You know, she's in some place spying on him creepily.
One's a girl that speaks no words but sends like threatening text messages to people.
Yeah.
One's just an OCD perfectionist. I think she's the homeroom leader, the class leader.
Yeah, I don't know, but anyway, I mean the point was they with each successive episode they're starting to pile on, right? Each character that they've explored in depth and shown their weird trait, now they get a slice of time in every episode to do their thing. And I think it's after a few episodes, it starts being really funny.
Oh yeah, after a few, it's great the first episode. I mean, then there's the teacher who Itoshiki inevitably kind of goes to vent his problems with, like one day he's talking about the corruption of man. The other he's talking about some imagined Yakuza plot to steal all the credit card information of people that go on the train.
Yeah, that's, I guess that's the other thing that they do. You know, he has this wild imagination about how things are going to go horribly wrong for him.
He's like the super pessimist.
Yeah, we should let LB talk, but I want to mention one thing before I forget about it. I think we talked earlier about how director Shinbo likes to use, depending on the situation, shadows or silhouettes,
mm-hmm.
and very high contrast scenes with only a few colors. When I was watching this show, I thought about that. And realize that, you know, this is an adaptation of a popular manga, and these are the sorts of things that mangas do anyway, because, you know, they can't afford to print multiple colors on things, and it's a very fitting style for adapting a manga. I thought that struck me as interesting.
What I noticed about Zetsubo Sensei as I was watching it, this was the first time that I had gotten to experience the series. I had never seen it before, but I started preparing for this podcast. I totally agree that, A, this is definitely just dark comedy, like all the way through. There is, within the first few seconds, I knew right, which the first few seconds were almost jarring. To me to watch, because it starts with the first 10 to 15 seconds are just these beautiful, gorgeous, you know, like like Matt just mentioned, high contrast shots of the sakura tree and the beautiful spring day and the happy, cheery girl walking through the park, and then suddenly she stumbles across a guy who's trying to hang himself, And it's just a really sharp 180 right there that gives you an idea of what you're in for, which I thought was really interesting. But my main note as I was watching this is that the constant cuts from like character to character and the background jokes of things that were written on the chalkboards that were constantly changing and the inserts of title cards every, you know, couple of minutes. For me, it felt like this was a rehearsal for Bakemonogatari. Feel free to, you know, tell me that I'm insane and that I'm just imagining that. But for me, it really felt like it was kind of a rehearsal for that. A lot of things in jokes and style of this series ended up being, you know, honed and used again in the Monogatari series. So this felt like, you know, a dress rehearsal for that in a way.
I definitely agree there, because you could tell he was really starting to refine and kind of lock down his style at that point. I mean, some of the stuff was a little out there, like that random director face there. Or the random. But a lot of it, yeah, you did start seeing it in stuff like Bakemonogatari, and going even further, you started seeing it, even if it wasn't as pronounced, you'd see it in stuff like, say, Nisekoi, Makoku City Actors. It really felt like he was starting to kind of gel and solidify his style again.
I was looking through my notes, and I kind of regret that I didn't mention this before, but actually I did. Like, all of the weird visual changes that sort of bring you back to, you know, bring back your focus to what the characters are saying audibly. I found that the same thing was true with Zetsubou Sensei. But what I found interesting there was that he didn't use the exact same sort of visual style when he was making those, you know, crazy rapid transitions while people were talking. Instead, it would be an element of the comic that he incorporated, you know, as opposed to like a random image. So I think this show in particular, it kind of shows him asserting his style in a way that the original author can be happy with. You know, that's the impression I got from this. Because, you know, instead of like, you know, showing a flying toaster or whatever you want, whatever you want to imagine, the main character opens a locker and sees the shut-in girl in there, you know, with her creepy eyes.
That returns the corner.
He's talking to the class and he looks under his podium and there's the stalker girl, you know?
Mm. Yeah, definitely, definitely. It's really kind of interesting to see how he worked within the confines of... I mean, it's an adaptation, but he really kind of managed to work with it to make something that was both incredibly familiar, but at the same time, all his own.
Yeah, it's still his. I think the reason why that struck me as very interesting is just considering another director we all admire, Hideaki Anno, who, you know, had legendary battles with mangaka over the direction of his work. I'm not sure if the air was heavy between Shinbo and his authors, but you know, obviously they weren't able to shut him down or anything, and it seemed like everybody could be happy with the result.
Yeah, exactly. Well, even then, he managed to get some of that more extreme stuff in there, too. Like, during some of those monochrome scenes, instead of having, like, just a silhouette, just monochrome, they'd have, like, one of the girls with, like, almost that death mask look to her. Like, the black eyes with almost, like, a black tear streaming down. Which, it really was something that was kind of interesting as a visual, like, a visual nod in some of those more dark moments, you know? All right, so we're going to be moving on to a series that probably most of you listeners have at least heard of, if not, you know, watched through one of its many, many shows at this point, whether it's Bakken, Nisei, second series, and so on. It is a good number of them at this point. Anyway, we're talking about the Monogatari series. Specifically for this one, it was Bakken Monogatari, which revolves around Koyomi Aragi, a senior in high school who at one point was a vampire. He's getting better.
He's a recovering vampire. Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently in this world, vampires inflict alcoholism.
Oh, both of them drink.
Well, yeah, sure. Anyway, one day, as he's going up this impossible staircase, he sees classmate Hitagi Senjogahara. I know I'm going to be butchering these pronunciations, so send your hate mail to me.
More or less pretty good, I think.
Yeah, that sounded all right to me.
All right. I think it wasn't she, like, slipped on a banana peel or something like that and started falling down the stairs. Anyway, she started falling down the stairs in either way. And Koyomi catches her to find out that she is, like, 100% weightless. Like, completely in defiance of any science and physics.
And, of course, he fell madly in love with her.
Oh, of course he did. And she kind of, you know, makes it clear she doesn't want to be fucked with by threatening to, you know, kill him with any office supplies that she has on her, which are quite plentiful. Quite plentiful. It's like, it's almost like watching claws come out. Anyway, Koyomi offers it to help and introduces her to Meme Oshino, which is a middle-aged dude living in this old rundown building who help Koyomi kind of get over his vampirism. And that kind of sets everything in motion. As Senjogahara agrees to be his friend, and various other girls with different oddities, including child ghosts, vampires, and stuff like that, kind of get involved with his life as they, you know, shenanigans.
I feel the Japanese are playing with us at this point. You know, Hitagi is easy to say, but they want us to say Senjogahara.
Exactly.
In as terrible a Western pronunciation as possible.
As far as Shinbo shows go, if it's either this or Madoka Magica, these are the ones that people are going to recognize, you know? And in Bakke, particularly, we were discussing this with Zetsubo. You really started to see that style kind of crystallize into a more defined version of itself at this point. Like, you started seeing the random flashes during conversations, that wonderful use of impossible space, which I do adore. I'm not gonna lie, I love that use of impossible space. His overlays, the silhouetting, the sharp backgrounds. I mean, you really start to see that stuff.
I think the staircase was, you know, the tower staircase, I'm assuming it was, is that wasn't really an impossible staircase, but it was a exaggerated staircase in its breadth and scope.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
There was something I wanted to say and gravitated to that and said, what was it? Oh, I have a confession to make about Bakke Monogatari.
What's that?
I found the fact that it's a portmanteau of Bakemono, which means monster, and Monogatari, which is a story. I found that really irritating, and I didn't want to watch just because of that.
Well, I mean, to be fair, that's not his fault.
Yeah, I know.
This is based on a series of short stories by Nisio Isin.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, whoever came up with that name is at fault, obviously. But you know, I from the little that I was able to watch of this, I very much enjoyed it. So I'm definitely going to finish that show.
This was the show, and again, you know, if you disagree with me, feel free to absolutely say so. But I feel like, you know, Mike kind of hit the nail on the head earlier that this was probably the show that put Akiyuki Shimbo, like, really on the map and really made people take notice of him.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, outside of Madoka Magica, this was his biggest work.
At the very least, it made Aniplex notice him.
True enough.
Yeah, I mean, with but this show...
I can agree with that.
Oh, sorry, go on.
No, I can agree with that. That's all I was going to say.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, with this show, this was, like, probably the point where Akiyuki Shimbo was really given, you know, the free rein to just go nuts. Not as nuts as, like, Madoka Magica, which we'll talk about later. But with this one, I mean, you have the constant cuts. You have, like, how many different animation styles does he use in a single episode?
Oh, yeah. And even the first episode, he jumps from, like, the traditional animation to 3D usage to almost like a papercraft look. It keeps bouncing between styles, which is really fascinating. Then you have, like, actual photo splicing at points.
Yeah, so, I mean, with this one, it definitely felt like this was one of the first series where he was really allowed to just, you know, like I said, go nuts. And he made a lot of bold choices that, again, I think that's part of the reason why, you know, he was put, that this series put him on the maps so much, is that he really showed, you know what, I've got, you know, these years of practice, and this is what... This is what all those years of practice have led to. And like I said earlier, Zetsubo Sensei felt like a rehearsal for that, that he was really close to what he wanted to be able to do, but not quite there yet. But Monogatari, Bakemonogatari in particular, was the series where he was finally able to cement it in his mind. Of, you know what, this is my style, this is what I want to present to the world. And it really worked for him. Like I said, I mean, this ended up becoming one of the highest selling series of its time. I don't know, I think other series have surpassed it by now, but at the time, I believe this became one of the highest selling series, like, ever.
I think it did. I mean, it's a series that'll sell out no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And it really didn't hurt that the short stories themselves translated so well to Shimbo's approach to storytelling, which really helped it. Like, it seemed like the almost like a melding of the minds there. Like, he was able to deliver in the way he wanted to because the work complemented what he was aiming to go for.
I still want to pronounce that as Bakemono Monogatari. It really bugs me for some reason. Yeah, I mean, I can pretty much agree with what you guys just said. I feel like he's been given enough free rein in the series that he can incorporate the things that he liked from the earlier works that he did. Like, I noticed a couple of things where, like, really elaborate face and eyeball shots that were all over Cosette. And, you know, things that I saw in Soul Taker, too, where, you know, you might see... you know, eyes looking left, eyes looking right, and then some completely different image. I want to say I saw that a couple of times in Monogatari too. Another thing that may not have been used so much earlier was I saw a couple of cuts where there was just lips moving, and I found that to be strangely interesting too. You know, it's that there's so little, because when you restrict the movement so severely, you can really amp up the detail. And I like that kind of style where, you know, most of it's still, But you managed to fit that within the budget, as it were, because you're only moving so little.
Absolutely.
There is kind of an elephant in the room that I'd like to to bring up, that Koyomi Araragi is a complete perv.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's no denying that.
As Mike would likely rant about for years on end, that comes out heavily in Nisei Monogatari.
Yeah, I mean, this is Nisei Monogatari was kind of the whole, like, that whole coming to a head. I hate to say it, but I actually stopped watching the Monogatari with Nisei because of that, because it's just like, it turned me off. I might just skip Nisei and go straight into the second series there, second season.
Yeah, second series is, it brings it right back.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so it's much, I didn't watch all of the second season, which I still kick myself over. I just lost track of it when it was first running. But I would really like to go back and just completely finish it off. But I can tell you from what I did see, it brings it right back to what made the first season really good.
Oh, fantastic.
So no toothbrush scene.
No, not that I recall.
Oh my God.
No, the toothbrush scene did it for me. It's like, yeah, I'm done. Because, I mean, there's a point where, you know, it's like, there's interesting creative, then there's just, okay, this is done to satisfy someone's fetish.
Seeing the toothbrush scene before I even watched any of the shows, it kind of made me had a violent reaction to any mention of the sisters.
Sorry.
Yeah, the whole sister thing is, oh man.
Awkward.
And, you know, even Shimbo doesn't escape that. Obviously, because he has no control over some of the source material that he has to direct. Even way back in Soul Taker, it's all about the sister.
Yeah.
Yeah, and unfortunately, so long as it's a popular thing that sells copies, it's not going away.
Nope.
There was one thing I wanted to mention about Bakemono.
Oh, go for it.
What's that?
There's one episode fairly early in that Hitagi and Koyomi are peddling what looks like a raw steak around a playground.
Yeah.
On a track.
Yeah.
So I think in a way that scene says everything about Shinbo's directing style.
It really does.
It's like it's literally a raw steak with petals sticking out of it.
As a side note, I didn't realize that Shimbo directed a Hidemaru sketch.
Yeah, he did.
Oh man, I love that series.
I keep meaning to watch it, and I just never have the time.
Likewise. I mean, I've seen the first season, but I have the rest still in shrink wrap. I have to watch through.
Mm-hmm.
Next on the list, kind of really open up the late career of Akiyuki Shimbo, Puella Magi Madoka Magica. I mean, this is one that pretty much everybody knows. I mean, this is a series that Aniplex can sell $70 Blu-rays for 4 episodes type of thing. I mean, it's a fan favorite. It's cash cow. And it's incredibly well known.
But what's it about?
I'm working on it now. I'm getting to that. Basically, it's set in the city of Mitakihara, Japan, where middle school student Madoka Kaname and her friend Sayaka Miki come across... the plot synopsis won't do much justice, but they're basically average kids. Madoka has a strange dream where she's running up this impossible stairway and walks out to this almost like a ruined cityscape where she sees a mysterious girl fighting off, well, monsters. Almost like a magical girl type thing. And it's there she first sees Kyubi, that little white cat thing, who tells her she needs to be a magical girl. Then she wakes up, goes to school, and lo and behold, that strange girl she saw in a dream transfers into her class. This girl, Homura Akemi, basically warns her against making the contract with QB to become a magical girl. And one thing leads to another, and, well, it happens anyway.
You should just call him Qbert. That's what I'd like to do.
From that point on, she kind of learns the responsibilities of becoming a magical girl and that whole life of, you know, sadness, anguish, suffering, hatred. It's not a fun life. And on top of that, magic girls have to give up their souls to not only be the source of the magic, but, well, anymore, and I'll kind of be spoiling stuff. So anyway, this is probably the Shinbo title that everybody knows at this point. It's really big. Like, it's one of the most popular Netflix titles big. Well, Netflix anime titles. I'm not going to get too big here, but anyway.
There's anime on Netflix? Get out.
I know, right? I mean, who would have thunk? Anyway, honestly, I can say this now. I'll say it from the outset. I do not like Madoka Magica at all. I respect it, but I don't like it. So I'm going to be kind of recusing myself from this discussion for a lot of it. Which I know both Matt and LB can do good justice to this one.
I don't know about that. I'd like to mention my experience, because I feel like it was sort of unusual too. There was all this hype about this title, and, you know, people were insanely in love with it. And, you know, just that very fact kind of turned me off for a while. And when I just finally decided to watch it, it gave me low expectations for the show. And my low expectations were exceeded. It's a little bit ironic, I think. I like the show because everybody convinced me that I probably wouldn't ahead of time.
The thing about this show that I think really just caught people, and I'm going to do my best to avoid giving out any major spoilers, even though at this point, like, everyone and their uncle has pretty much seen this show. The thing is with Madoka Magica is that we knew that it was an Akihiko Shimbo show, and we knew that it was a Gen Urobuchi show. So we knew that it was going to be a little weird. We didn't know through the first two episodes, it was a very standard, you know, magical girl, will she, won't she kind of show. It wasn't, you know, there was nothing really wild about it. You know, there were some really unique visuals, Shimbo being Shimbo. And when we got to episode three, that's when we saw, okay, you know, this is Shimbo probably at his most experimental. He had already established what kind of style he wanted to do, but he wanted to push it even further. And that is shown in the first, like, Witch's Labyrinth in episode three. And the series and his style goes even further than it ever had before, which, like I said earlier, I think this was him experimenting even more. And in my opinion, I think that it really worked for him. I really liked the visual style that he pushed. I really liked that he pushed the envelope even further. My girlfriend and I actually will go back and forth on this because I sat her down and she watched it. She watched the movie versions with me. And her opinion is that, you know, the director was doing really bad drugs to come up with those witches' labyrinths. And then I'm on the complete opposite side. I think that, you know, this was him pushing the envelope and really doing, you know, and doing something really unique and interesting. One of the notes that I
have... In addition to bad drugs.
Absolutely. one of the notes that I have about this series is that I think it's going to be a really long time before we see a series as visually striking as this one, if ever. Even if Shimbo decides to revisit this type of experimenting in a future work, he's not going to be able to recapture the magic that he got with this one. That's my opinion, at least.
I can agree there. I mean, it would be like going back to Ava 20 years later, like we're seeing now. I mean, it would probably still be well received, but it definitely wouldn't be anywhere close to what that original Raw vision was.
I feel like everything he does came to a head in this show. So there's the elaborate witches' labyrinths and witch appearances where you're almost detached from the whole thing. The magical girl enters, and she's in this strange world where she might die, and nobody but the viewer is privy to what's happening in that labyrinth. And, you know, maybe the labyrinth itself is only an approximation of what the magical girl is actually seeing and dealing with. But the show also anchors us in what all of the girls are feeling in response to what they do in those labyrinths and while fighting those witches. So that gives us a baseline for how we should feel about it, right? Which I think is brilliant. I really love that effect. I guess the other thing, visually speaking, was something that I kind of took from Soul Taker, was the during one or more of the fights in Soul Taker, there was this destruction of an urban area, you know, from the fighting. And I took that as being, you know, sort of visceral to, you know, a visceral feeling that anybody seeing that would have if they had experienced a earthquake. So that sort of stuck with me. That's one of the Shinboisms in my list, the urban destruction motif. I don't know. I'm speaking a little bit.
Yeah, no,
that's actually
a really good point. I hadn't even, you know, thought about that, but that's actually in a lot of his darker series. You know, that is a common thread that I hadn't really picked up on. So yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, definitely, it's a great observation.
I guess the only other thing I wanted to say about Madoka was actually a couple of things. One of them visual. And I didn't really notice this in any other show. If you look at the school setting and the way the classrooms are drawn and portrayed, it's almost like this awkward clinical setting. You know, we are seeing everything that goes on in all of the classrooms because they're all made of glass. You know, almost like it's an experiment or something. I found that unsettling, but you know, it didn't really have much bearing on how the show played out. Just one of those things, I guess. And I would say the chief thing that drew me into the show was the Cubae, the incubator, and how you know, initially when I had exposure to that, there was, you know, the whole Faustian bargain of you can have any wish you want granted, but you're basically trading your soul for it, and that never seems to go well in literature, right? And the other thing that struck me about that whole situation was how the girls, the show is almost a statement about how girls should be more selfish or care for themselves better, because they never wished for something that would benefit themselves. That definitely struck me as, and you know, these things were not necessarily directorial attributes. I just, they combined to make Madoka Magica special for me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with your observation there again. And like I've said many times throughout history. There's either on social media or to people in person. Madoka Magica for me was 2011 was probably one of the best years we had for anime in recent history. We had a lot of great series that year, but Madoka Magica will always go down as the best series of that year for me. I don't know how many times I've watched the show by now in different incarnations, but it still goes down as the best show of that year for me. And a big part of it is just because of how striking it is.
Yeah, definitely. The only other note I had for the show was that, I guess this is neither here nor there. This may be an effect of the... this may be, you know, something, an effect of incorporating the original work, but I liked the sort of almost colored pencil sketch look that a lot of the characters had. I noticed it in the intro and even, you know, in a lot of the scenes. It gave it a character that I hadn't really seen in other anime that I can think of. But I don't know. I'm not terribly great at talking about visual qualities of things.
That makes sense to me.
So the next cell we decided to cover was Meikaku City Actress, which is, if I remember correctly, this is part of the Kagura Project.
That is what Wikipedia seems to suggest.
Okay, cool. But anyway, that's not important. You Google it, guys, or check the show notes. We'll have some info on these. Anyway, the show revolves around Shintaro Kisaragi, an 18-year-old hikikomori, or, you know, shut-in, who is pretty much unemployed. He's a neat, not employed in education or training. So basically, his apartment is his home, his shelter, and his lover type of thing. anyway, he hasn't left in 2 years and kind of just lives online. And he's not entirely alone. I mean, he has a digital companion known as Ene, who is a cyber girl that looks suspiciously like Hatsune Miku in some ways. Wink, wink.
So he's entirely alone.
Yeah, he's entirely alone. I was trying to be nice. Anyway, on August 14th, due to some of the messing about of NA, his keyboard fries. And this is like the worst case scenario for Kisaragi, because he hasn't gone out in 2 years. He has not seen a human being in 2 years, mind you. And he's there are no same-day deliveries, no nothing, because it's a holiday. So he has to brave the outside world to go get a keyboard. So he goes to a department store where, just by his luck, a group of criminals break in and hold everyone inside hostage. And it's in here that he comes in contact with a group of teenagers that call themselves the Meikakushidan, who basically stop the robbery with some crazy powers, and they force Shintaro into the group just because, well, we wouldn't have a show if not.
We won't have no goddamn Mongolians breaking down our shitty wall.
Yes, we won't have any goddamn Mongolians breaking down our shitty wall. Anyway, yeah.
I'm just going to stop you. Not because you're
wrong.
Not because you're not describing it well, but it actually illustrates what... the trouble I had with getting into this series. And it took me, you know, several episodes over a fairly long period of time before I finally decided that it was worth watching to the end. Because I did not understand what was going on at all.
Yeah, it's incredibly abstract at points. Incredibly dense at points. Or it's like, they don't explain a lot of concepts well at the beginning.
It's just that they take a while to get to the point. And the point is like the spoiler of the series. And you know, I don't know if I like that format, but I would say I liked how it all turned out, but if I hadn't stuck with it, I would have a very poor opinion of the show.
Definitely. I mean, it's definitely not the most approachable show by any stretch of the word. Visually, it's striking. I mean, it makes great use of Shinbo's style, especially like that stark coloration and silhouetting that we saw in Soul Taker.
Yeah, I would confess that this is... I've kind of taken a roundabout way to watch all of this stuff. You know, we all agreed we wanted to watch this stuff, which is the only reason why I did watch some of it. And I'm definitely grateful for that. Mikako City Actors is the reason why I wanted to do this, because almost immediately it reminded me of Soul Taker. So that just goes to show that even if you're not enamored with Soul Taker, that's the kind of influence that show will have on you. I probably have other things to say, but I'll let you guys talk.
Well, for me, I mean, this show, the writing and story never really grabbed me. I never really got into this show that deeply. For me, the really interesting thing about this show was actually the different use of colors in the various scenes, which I felt overshadowed what the actual content of the show was, which is probably bad, but oh well. But I mean, like, things like in the robbery scene, all the characters are in black and white, but then you have to cut the bright red background. In the second and third episodes, there's a lot of scenes where it's almost entirely in black and white, except for and there are a lot of stark lines and, you know, white backgrounds with a very limited use of color, which I thought was really interesting. So, I mean, I like that it went back and forth and it kept me engaged in that way. But yeah, the story and writing just really didn't do much for me in this one.
Yeah, I've definitely got that on one of my lists, in my list of Shinboisms. The use of not only stark contrast in colors, and, you know, and sparse colors, but the use of shadow coupled with that. You know, how you had like telephone poles laying out the scene with their, you know, not their presence, but their shadows. And another one of my Shinboisms I have in the list is that he, and a lot of the scenes that he, that show up in his shows, he obeys the, what for photographers call the rule of thirds, where, you know, the subject of the scene will be offset in such a way that, you know, one third to the right and two thirds to the left, that sort of thing. And that has a, you know, that offset nature of it has a way of bringing out the subject in our view.
All right, definitely. I mean, I could say that is probably one of my favorite things about his approach, because it really kind of pulls a lot of the focus away from those static character shots. I mean, it gives some vibrancy and life to the environments as well, you know?
I'm just going to go through the few notes I have about this show. One thing I noticed in this show and others, especially in Madoka Magica, was that it's almost like Photoshop patterns that get repeated throughout his scenes. You know, they're fairly simple, but not super simple. You know, it's not something you could replicate just by looking at it. And they sort of lay out everything that's going on. And another thing I would say about the way that the patterns to work to lay out his scenes is they're a little bit, but not completely M.C. Escher like in style. You know, there's a lot of repetition, a lot of like, you know, it's very meta, and I noticed this a lot in Mekaku City, where you could just sort of stare at a scene and get sucked into it, its repetitive nature, as it were. So I definitely enjoyed that. You know, I think they're definitely inspired by M.C. Escher, even though it's not like, you know, an imitation of his work. Another thing I liked was the sort of urban fairy tale aspect of Mekaku City, where, you know, you're just sort of drawn into this, you know, that we meet these characters who have some sort of special ability, and, you know, whatever, it's Japan. We almost sort of expect that, right? You know, all of the outcasts have special powers for some reason. But then when they really get into the meat of the story and start pivoting toward who the main character actually is, I think that's when they get into, you know, more Madoka territory, where, you know, if you think about the elaborate witch labyrinths and the witches themselves, it's a similar art style when they describe this sort of fairy tale that weaves together this whole world, and I found that very interesting.
Definitely. Yeah, I think you summed it up very well. The last style we're covering tonight is one that kind of goes against the grain for a lot of these, because we've kind of talked about the more abstract, the more Shimbo-y Shimbo titles for the most part. So the last one might come as a bit of a surprise for people, but we'll be bringing up Nisekoi, which was, again, another fairly popular title that was... It has a surprisingly devoted fan base. Like, surprisingly.
I don't know. From what I've seen of it, it doesn't seem surprising to me at all.
Yeah, it's a charming show. Anyway, it revolves around a high school student named Raku Ichijo, who is the son of the leader of a Yakuza group. And his dream in life is to go on the straight and narrow, become a public servant, kind of leave that whole Yakuza life behind. But
there's a certain irony in all of that, but
oh yeah,
continue.
There is an irony in it, I'm not going to lie. But anyway, lately a new gang's been kind of moving in on his family's turf, and there's been talks of a possible gang war. At the same time, as he's going to school one day, he carries around this pendant from a girl he made a promise to like 10 years beforehand, and he ends up losing it after getting a knee kick to the face, unintentionally, of course, by some mysterious blonde girl. So already things are off to a wonderful start.
Yeah,
even better.
The girl scales a wall and flies into his face with her knees.
Without losing her toes, mind you. Which she keeps delicately in her mouth somehow. And as if things couldn't get any worse for Ichijo, this girl, Chitoge Kirasaki, ends up being the new transfer student. She's came in from the U.S., and she's basically, you know, the attractive newcomer. And obviously he hates her. And, well, unfortunately for him, he ends up being like her guide at school, the one that's assigned to help out, do all that stuff, and it just seems like the day couldn't get any worse. Till
it's almost like Madoka Magica take two.
Well, yeah, except, you know, no one dies in this one. Anyway,
I'm not saying the transfer student thing is a Shimboism. It definitely isn't. It's just a trope. It's just funny.
That's just a trope. Anyway, it gets even worse because at the end of the day, he hates her, she hates him, and they don't know anything about each other. Ichijo returns home. The father says, "I need to talk to you. We're to avert a war with this rival gang that's moved in. You're going to be pretending to date the daughter of the head of the family because I know the guy and we're friends and we'd rather not go to bloodshed." And lo and behold, it's Chitoge. Chitoge is the daughter of the rival gang. They have to pretend to be boyfriend and girlfriend for 3 years. Hilarity ensues. Did I nail it?
Yeah.
Yep, sounds about right. Knows.
I want to mention something that I neglected to earlier. When I was watching Zetsubou Sensei, I learned for the first time what the term returnee means. it's like a foreign girl who has some portion of Japanese, or a foreign person who has some portion of Japanese birth and has returned to Japan to, as more or less a foreigner, to attend school. I only thought of that because in Nisekoi, they talk about her behind her back as a returnee.
Mm. Yeah, they're not exactly held in the highest regards.
Yeah. You know, it's a gorgeous blonde-haired girl who speaks Japanese somehow but can't write it.
Right.
It's amusing.
Nisekoi for me is, in terms of its storytelling, it's one of the more frustrating series to get through because the quality of the story goes back and forth constantly. For like 3 or 4 episodes, it'll be, a really fun comedy, and then it'll just steep itself in tropes for a couple of episodes and slow down, and then it'll jump back, and it just goes back and forth throughout its like 20-21 episode run. So it's definitely one of the more frustrating series. In terms of visuals, I think it's one of the prettier series that Shimbo has done. I love the interesting backgrounds that he puts in, like randomly on a school top roof scene when everything is really dramatic. There are like planets in the sky for some reason.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make a lot of sense, but it looks really pretty. So That's one of those things that I really like about Nisekoi, is that it's just really gorgeous to look at. Mm. Like I said, the story is kind of frustrating in places, but it's got all sorts of neat little visuals. The one complaint that I have about this is that Shimbo just loves those effects, the sparkles and the flowers, and, everywhere. And like anytime someone enters a room, sparkle, 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 sparkle. It's like, really, tone it down.
Okay, I mean, you could really kind of tell, especially in episode one, that point where Ichijo and Chitoge see each other for the first time in the classroom and they start fighting. And as they talk, confetti just spews all over the place.
Yeah.
I like that sort of impossible couple story. I won't lie. Like, I find that most romantic comedies fall flat. And the ones where the couple is constantly fighting, especially from the very first moment, those just seem to work out so much better. At least for the viewer.
Definitely, definitely.
But I saw a little bit of what you guys are talking about. Like, there's a few scenes from like childhood where, I guess you don't really know where they are, but, there's, way more stars than you would see in a humid country like Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
so it seems out of place, and that's definitely a Shimboism. There, he has, I don't know what the visual analog is to anachronism, but that's what Shinbo does.
Definitely. And I mean, you do see some of the things like, you see some of the visual anachronisms kind of show up in like overlays. Like, there's some scenes
don't
where
say it that way. It's not an anachronism.
Oh yeah. I'm visual quirk is a better way of putting it. Visual quirk or element, something like that.
I guess out of place is the only way to say it.
Yeah. In a lot of the exterior scenes, you'll see like these little, like small bits of foliage are like overlaid, like they're just unnatural colors or something like that. And I mean, they're not as common as you'd see in, say, the Monogatari series or something like that, but they definitely kind of make themselves known when they appear.
As far as Nisekoi, my very first note is standard rom-com. Actually, my last note was Shinbo reined in.
note that.
I just wanted to clarify that, you know, it's definitely, you know it's him.
Mm.
In several subtle ways, but I want to say that when I watched this show, I felt like it was a very standard anime experience. It didn't really go out of the box in any way that I noticed, but to be fair, I was only able to watch a few episodes of the show.
If I could bring this up though, Nisekoi has actually had two directors, Shimbo and Naoyuki Tatsuya.
Okay.
So maybe it was the fact that he had to work with someone that kind of made him temper his approach, because basically you saw a similar effect with a more recent show, Gourmet Girl Graffiti, which Shimbo and Tatsuya cooperate on again. I mean, you definitely see those elements appear, but it's nowhere near as extreme as the stuff that he does on his own.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point to make, and totally worth bringing up.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's... with Nisekoi, yeah, it's definitely all very toned down from his normal style, which...
Yeah, and I don't see that as a fault. I mean, I enjoyed every moment of that show that I watched. It just... There was nothing in particular that really stood out about the visual style of the show. It was very, you know, it was almost like watching Haruhi or something like that, you know? It's just funny, and I enjoy it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think we are starting to get to the point where Shimbo is taking more of a backseat, and he's working with other directors a little bit more, and he's not working on as many series, you know, by himself. I think Nisekoi, he had a partner, Makaku City Actors, I think he was the last one he did by himself, if I'm not mistaken. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. And then Gourmet Girl Graffiti, he's working with someone. So I think he's starting to work with more people and help other directors come up a little bit more. I'm not 100% about that, of course, but it's starting to feel like he's starting to back off a little bit.
Absolutely. Actually, Mikaku, he was working with someone as well.
Oh, okay.
He was working with Yuki Yase.
Oh, okay.
Hmm. That's a name we should probably pay attention to later.
Definitely. It looks like still... fairly new. Mikaku City was a directorial debut, outside of, like, you know, episode director and storyboarder.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's one that we might want to keep an eye on going forward. But, yeah, I can definitely see that he's trying to kind of bring up a new generation of directors, which I can kind of admire that, because, I mean, something like that. It's if you can study under the master, why wouldn't you type of thing, you know?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Which, you know, thinking about it now, you know, it's not something that I was actively thinking about as I was preparing for this show and as we were recording it. But, you know, now that it's the thought is actually there that he's starting to dial back a little bit and train new directors and, you know, not direct as many series by himself, that's actually kind of sad. That makes me a little sad, actually.
Absolutely, because, I mean, it's definitely feels like it might be the end of an era.
It's hard to say, you know. I think it's going to come down to, you know, he's a very creative director with a very unique style, and a lot of people really appreciate that style, you know. Apparently us among those numbers. And I think it comes down to you know, how receptive the market is to that at any given time. You know, when you look at something like Madoka Magica, that kind of gave him life and was instrumental in being able to create Mekaku City Actors, which I frankly love. But then, you know, it's when you look at the span of a career, he's got to do a Nisei Koi here, a Zetsubou Sensei there, to have a chance at some point to do another one of the shows he really wants to do.
Oh yeah, that's totally makes sense.
Absolutely. All right, and that's our show, everybody. Thank you so much for joining, and a huge thanks to LB Bryant of Otaku Review for joining us this week. And LB, where can we reach you outside of the podcast?
Well, I am posting pretty much daily at otakureview.net. And if you want to just hit me up and say hi, you can find me on Twitter at otakureview.
All right. Fantastic. And till next time, this is Mike Ferrero.
Sorry about this. This is Matt Brown. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. And remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. It really helps us out. And until next time, have a great evening.